Welcome to On Mic with Jordan Rich, my podcast celebrating the performing arts, broadcasting, music, drama, comedy, writing, and so much more. Joining me today is Emmy-winning author Jeffrey Mark, who's penned a terrific new book. It's called Ella, a biography of the legendary Ella Fitzgerald. It's a book that not only covers her entire musical career with many never-before-seen photos, interviews, and anecdotes, but it also reveals the private side of the First Lady of Song. So now a chat with Jeffrey Mark. Jeffrey, delighted to welcome you to On Mic with Jordan Rich. Before we get started, I recall meeting the great Ella Fitzgerald up close and personal. She was doing a concert in Boston in the mid-1970s and was a guest of the mayor at that time, Kevin White, at a place called the Parkman House, where he entertained guests of all kinds. And I met the lady herself, and I was in awe. It felt like meeting royalty.
She really was, and you were meeting her at a very important time in her life, because in 1974, she was just bouncing back from having been really, really ill with diabetes. And in 1971, 72, 73, she was working very, very, very part-time. She was getting bleeding in her eyes, and she was having operation after operation to save her eyesight. And it kind of sort of didn't work. So Ella's eyesight by that point was almost legally blind. But she was just hitting her stride. She had just started recording with Pablo Records and was becoming the Ella we knew a little bit later. So you met her at a really, it's interesting that you did at that moment, very, very pivotal point in her career.
I remember she was seated in a beautiful chair in this, what they call the Parkman House, which is the mayor's sort of mansion at the time. And she was literally being treated as the royalty she deserved to be. And I remember shaking hands with her and just almost genuflecting. I couldn't stand it. But she was so sweet and so nice. But she obviously was having vision issues, as you say. Let's delve into this. Your book is really chock full of biographical and musical information. And what have you brought us that we didn't know perhaps as much about Ella? We have the basic biography, those of us who know her, but there are a lot of things about her life that come to light here in the book. What are some of those that hit you?
Well, I think we have to preface your question, which is a wonderful question, by the way, with the idea that Ella Fitzgerald, for all of her publicness, we're talking about a woman, the first African-American woman to lead her own orchestra, the largest Grammy winner in history, the most recorded voice, female voice, in history. There's more available of her on CD than any other artist. For all of that, she was a terribly, terribly shy and private woman. She did not like discussing her personal life. Her childhood and early years were so completely sanitized for us that they were practically fiction. And in the later years, she had romances like everybody else does. She had a child. She had all these illnesses. She fought for three decades, but never discussed them, even with her closest friends. So what we're getting in my book that nobody knows is, okay, so what was her childhood really like? And what happened to her as a teenager? And how did she make the transition from being this ragamuffin who was living on the streets of Harlem to becoming this legend? And it doesn't happen overnight, although the pivotal moments that turn her from one thing to the next are unplanned, and one of those, you have to think there's some divine intervention here. So I think, besides the fact that the book literally, song by song, album by album, almost concert by concert, if you're a music geek and you want to know about the music, there is no stone unturned. But for those of you who want to know about the woman and what made her tick and what brought her from here to there, that's all brand new information to the public.
And of course, we have a woman who rose to the top of the entertainment field in an era when blacks and African-Americans particularly were still dealing with segregation, with outright racism and bigotry. Not that she superseded any of that, but she certainly fought through it in her own dignified way. And she almost crossed through cultural and racial bounds seemingly at ease because she had such presence.
Everything you just said was well-spoken and ridiculously true, except the very last thing. It was not easy. It was hard. Ella kicked down doors. Now, a shy woman, for her to build up the self-confidence and the will to kick down doors, we can't dismiss this out of hand as though it was easy for her, because she was battling more than one thing. She was battling being African-American at a time when the people who were her contemporaries were being treated so poorly, so badly. African-Americans in general, African-American performers specifically. And the other thing we have to bring into this, and this is Women's History Month, is how badly she was treated as a woman, that she was this female with no real man advocating for her for most of her career, and yet she breaks through for women. So if you would imagine, many of our friends out there listening, if you remember the old show Get Smart, and he goes down, 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 and there's all these different doors that have to open for him before he can get anywhere near his destination. On Get Smart, they open automatically, electronically. For Ella Fitzgerald, she had to kick them down one by one by one. And she never, ever got enough credit for that. There are other African-American performers who came after her who were very happy in their autobiographies to take a huge bow for what they did. And I don't diminish anything these people, male and female, did. But they couldn't have done what they did if Ella Fitzgerald hadn't done it first. Without Ella, there was no Sammy Davis Jr., or Sarah Vaughan, or Carmen McRae, or Diana Ross, or Michael Jackson, or Beyonce, and I'm just talking about African-American performers. Mm. Ella kicked down the door for Latinos, for Jews, for women, for gays. She so demanded equal treatment that she became the standard bearer for equal treatment, and performers got it across the board. Because as we're talking, it is 2018. Maybe this show will be repeated in 2019. So I'll tell you, we're still in 2018, folks. And in 2018, African Americans and women and Latinos and gays, things have improved tremendously. But there is still prejudice, and there is still this idea that somehow those minorities aren't quite as acceptable as the vast majority in this country. And this is the 21st century when these things are supposed to be over, and they're not. But go back three or four generations ago, back to the 1930s when Ella is first getting started, and being a black woman is almost unheard of in show business. Unless you're going to play maids in films and in Broadway shows, there was no television. There were almost no African Americans on the radio. Even Amos and Andy were two white men playing black men. Mm. There was nothing. There was nothing to pave the way for Ella. There would have been no Lena Horne in films had it not been for Ella. And Lena got the shaft. But at least she was there, not playing maids.
Right.
So I cannot overemphasize Ella Fitzgerald's importance in show business history.
You brought it together so beautifully in that short dissertation on what's different about this book, and we're certainly learning a lot about the struggle, and I'm glad you were able to encapsulize that. Can you take us back to the early days when she's starting to be known, and I guess the Chick Webb experience would be, for most of us who are followers of hers, the first time we heard her on record. Who was Chick Webb, and why is he instrumental in her life at that time?
Excellent question. Chick Webb was a small time is the wrong word. He was not the big star that his contemporaries Count Basie and Duke Ellington were. He was an African-American band leader, but not as big as they were yet. He was very short. He wasn't a little person, but he wasn't much taller than a little person. And he was born with tuberculosis of the spine. So his body was in the shape of a question mark. He was an incredible jazz drummer, but couldn't front his own band. I think had Chick Webb lived into middle age, we would remember him today as the greatest jazz drummer who ever lived. Instead, remember him as this band leader who found Ella Fitzgerald. And it is because of Chick that Ella got to record, because Chick had a recording contract with Decca Records. And once Ella became part of the band, there were records made with Ella Fitzgerald. And it's an amazing thing. They were the house band at the Savoy Ballroom in Harlem. And they began having a series of battles of the bands. So it would be Chick and Ella against Duke Ellington and whoever his male singer with time was, and Count Basie and whoever his male singer was, and Benny Goodman and Billie Holiday, and they always won. Hmm. And now the Webb Orchestra was taking a place of importance equal to Count Basie and Benny Goodman and Duke Ellington because of Ella. It started out with Chick Webb and then Little Letters with Ella Fitzgerald. And then it was Chick Webb and Ella Fitzgerald, and then they were side by side, Chick Webb and Ella Fitzgerald. And towards the end, it was Ella Fitzgerald and Chick Webb. The more she recorded, the more they toured together, and even their getting together was this fluke. Do we have time to tell the story of how they met?
Oh, please, yes.
Well, Ella's mother, sometimes when you talk to Jeffrey, Mark, there's a story, and there's a story inside of a story. So I've got to give you a story inside of a story, but folks, take my hand. I won't let you get lost. I'll take you with me on this story. So Ella is living in Yonkers, New York, with her mother and her Portuguese, quote-unquote, stepfather, meaning the man living with her mother, but they were never married. And Ella's mother dies around the time she's 14. The stepfather takes her mother's death by taking to alcohol and physically, mentally, and sexually abusing Ella. So Ella runs away from home to her aunt's house, didn't like it there, runs away from home again, and because she was African-American and a female, she was picked up by the law and taken to this home for wayward girls. It was worse than anything Charles Dickens came up for any of the children in his novels, and even more so worse for the African-American girls, because they were segregated, put into these substandard bungalows, given torn clothing, almost nothing to eat. And in their own records, it shows that Ella Fitzgerald was regularly taken down to the basement and tortured. So Ella ran away from there, and it was such a bad school, they let her. And she runs to the streets of Harlem, where she becomes a numbers runner and lives in a house of ill repute, not as a sex worker, but as a lookout, so that if anyone suspicious or a cop was coming, Ella could let them know. She literally lived out the window, looking up and down the streets. She was, as someone said at the moment, a good girl living a bad life. And she decided that the only way to get out of the bad life was show business. And in the mid-1930s, unless one wanted to be a domestic helper, that really was all one could do as an African-American person. It was show business. It was the only out for any kind of a real life where money could be made and one could have self-respect. But there was no thought of being a singer. Ella loved to dance. She was a hep dancer, and she wanted to call herself Snake Hips Fitzgerald, okay, because she was thin back then. And she applied for amateur hours and got called for one, and she showed up with her ladies of the evening with her for support. They were very good to her. The last act on the bill was a black act called the Edwards Sisters, who Ella called the dancingest sisters she ever saw. They did this flash act of one step after another. They took your breath away. They were so good. Now they call out Ella Fitzgerald. And she said, I can't go out there. I can't follow them. And the ladies of the evening literally pushed her on stage, where a spotlight hit her in the kisser for the first time. And we'll never know who loved who more, Ella loving the spotlight or the spotlight loving Ella. And she gingerly walked across the stage, and some wise guy in the audience yelled, what's she gonna do? And she went over to the MC, and he said, honey, you gotta do something. Can you sing? And she said, I'm so nervous. The only song I can remember the lyrics to is Judy by Connie Boswell, who was her favorite singer. He said, we had that arrangement. Hang on. And they played it, and she sang, and she won. And she won every contest she went into as a singer. None of this was pre-thought out. None of this was pre-arranged. It just worked out this way. This brought her to the attention of Chick, who didn't want her. Her guys wanted her. She was ill-kempt. She didn't know how to do her hair, put on makeup. She didn't even know how to bathe properly. And the guy said to her, you know what, Chick? A beauty parlor can do wonders for a woman. And she sang for him, and he said, all right, we're going to Yale on Thursday. If the Yaleys like you, you're in. The Yaleys loved her. It turned on a dime.
Interesting.
Like that for her. But the next few years, she was this sponge musically. Being with, because Chick's organization was wonderful, learning everything the musicians did. She never wanted to be left behind by anything. She never wanted to fall behind the band. She took notes, copious notes, on what the guys were doing and how they were doing it, and she rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed. And that's how she leads up to being the star of the show, along with Chick.
Great
and
stories.
Then comes a Tisket a Tasket, and that blows them sky high.
Hey, thanks for listening to the show On Mic with me, Jordan Rich. We'll get right back to it in a moment. I wanted to remind you, you'll find links to my website and Facebook page in the show notes. Reach out to me anytime. I'd love to hear your ideas for future shows and guests and topics. And if you happen to have a free moment, I'd love for you to rate and review the podcast in all the important places we hang out, including Apple, Android, Google Play, Stitcher, and more. That'll go a long way in helping us build an audience and keep the studio humming with interesting content. And now, back to more On Mic with me, Jordan Rich. We're talking here with Jeffrey Mark, the author of Ella, a biography of the legendary Ella Fitzgerald. And she did collaborate with some pretty amazing people, and it was almost effortless. Tell us a little bit about she and Louis in this case.
Well, I think everybody in show business knew Louis. Louis had become, he has a place in show business I don't think anybody else has ever had before or since. He was almost a goodwill ambassador for American music all over the world. And Ella and Louis had a very brotherly, sisterly kind of relationship. He always called her sis. He kind of took her under his wing. She didn't sing like he did. Billie Holiday is more of a, not an imitator, but was more influenced by Louis's music than Ella was. But Ella understood what Louis did. Ella understood his brand of scat singing and didn't imitate him, but did imitate somebody else. We were talking before the break about A Tisket a Tasket and Chick Webb. A Tisket a Tasket is this enormous song of hers that becomes this big hit that she co-writes. And now she's up there where the entire world is like, she's number one in pop. And 6 months later, Chick Webb dies, and she takes over the orchestra. And I mention all of this because we're talking about scat singing. Dizzy Gillespie joins Ella's Famous Orchestra, as it was now called. And it was really Dizzy that Ella was imitating. She realized that he played differently than anybody. And she began to vocally mimic and improvise off of what he was doing on his horn. And that was the beginning of her scat singing. And Ella and Louis recorded in the 1940s for Decca, because they both belonged to the same record label. And then Can't We Be Friends was a Verve album of Ella and Louis. By this point, Ella is more mature, hitting 40, And really, the voice is her own. She and Louis sing very, very differently. In fact, in some of the songs they do, they have to change the keys in between them because their voices are different. But she is now the premier scat singer. She had learned so well from Dizzy and from Louis and from the other guys and the bands that she worked with through the years that she was able to be really another instrument in the band, whether she was with a trio or a quartet or a 17-piece big band or a full symphony orchestra. She was one more instrument. She wasn't just a singer anymore. Mm. She was an instrument. And certainly she has to give thanks to Louis. It's funny that when they would go into the studio to record things, especially the studio session that brought us Can't We Be Friends, that particular studio session was with a small group. There was no arrangements were made ahead of time. It was all called what they call head arrangements. It's worked out in the studio. There's no music. People just figure it out and they record it. But to keep Ella loose, meaning to keep her from not getting nervous, because Ella was always nervous when she performed, which is amazing considering she probably did more live performances than any other performer in music history. But she was so intent on being good that she was always nervous. So Louis would say, "Hey, sis," and then say some horribly dirty thing to her to make her laugh, to loosen her up, and then he'd say, "Okay, now," so that she'd have this smile in her voice from hearing this dirty joke of his, and it comes across in their music together that she's so happy to be there.
Oh, yeah.
And so happy in the singing, but especially Can't We Be Friends, I think, is the best thing the two of them ever did together. Done in one take, no rehearsal.
I did not know that, although it sounds so effortless as fan of this kind of thing. I marvel at how beautiful and effortless it appears. And when you look at Ella's body of work, her live performances that are captured on record are truly inspiring and exciting. And I wanted to just chat with you about the fact that she traveled all over the world to these exotic places. But one concert in particular stands out as a fan, and that's the Berlin concert. What year was that, by the way, Jeff?
It's 1960, and I must tell you a story inside of a story again. So I hope we have the time for this, because kids, you're going to love this.
Okay, I'm ready.
This is another one of those, this couldn't have happened, but it did. So we have to take our time machine back now to the early 1930s before Ella performs. There is this musical in Berlin about a slasher. Lots of fun, but this is Nazi Germany, so this was the tenor of the times.
Yes.
And the writers of this musical and the librettist, the man who wrote the story, were all Jewish. So they left while they still could and came to the United States and got Kurt Weill to write English lyrics, and they got an American libretto in English. And the show opened first off Broadway and then on Broadway and was called the Three Penny Opera. And there's this one song in German and in English, and I believe they brought the performer with them because it's the same voice. It is sung in this slow, lugubrious, funereal, kind of flat voice because it's a very dark song.
Right, right.
You need to know all this to understand how
right.
this came about. 20 years go by. And for reasons I've never been able to understand, whether it was this person's A&R people who did this, his producer, or Bobby Darin himself, decided to take this song out of the musical and make it into this finger-snapping, up-tempo hipster song. We're referring to Mac the Knife, of course. So he has this number one hit with Mac the Knife. The way he sings it goes totally against the lyrics. Well, Louis Armstrong, here we go again, hears this and does a cover version of it for his next album. And Louis has a number one hit with it. This is almost impossible in music history to have two different people with the same song go to number one. So now we go, this is 1959, these two men make the song. It is now February of 1960, and Ella is about to open in West of Berlin, back when Berlin was split, at the concert hall in front of 10,000 people. And her manager was a man by the name of Norman Granz, and a lot of wonderful things can be said about him, and some not nice things can be said about him. We don't have time for either one. All you have to know is he was her manager. He mostly made really good decisions on her behalf musically. They were just starting to break through to where Ella was being considered a legend because of her songbooks of the great composers of the 20th century. And he knew that we were recording possibly what might be an album. He recorded almost every concert she did just in case. And he came backstage and he said, "Ella, I want you to sing Mack the Knife." And Ella, because she trusted Norman so and always did what he said, turned to him and said, "No, I am not singing Mack the Knife. I don't understand the song. I don't know the lyrics. I think it's stupid. We haven't rehearsed it. Why would I do this?" And Paul Smith, who was her pianist for many, many years, was backstage and said, "Ella, look, we can do this. I can make this little vamp for you. And just sing what you want. And when you're done singing, whatever much of it you want to do, we'll just go on to the next song." And then the coup de grace was that Norman turns to her and said, "Ella, this is Germany. You're singing English lyrics. They won't know what you're singing. You'll be singing the phone book for all they know. But they'll recognize the tune as a German tune and give you a nice big round of applause." And she said, "Okay, you're so intent, I'll do it." And she goes out, and as you're about to hear, she tells the audience, "I've never heard a girl do this. Don't know if I know all the words." And she begins to sing it. And Mack the Knife, for those of you who have never heard this song before, is almost a blues. It's one little piece of the story after the next, each one a half a step higher in tone. And she gets through 2, 3, 4 of these, tries to get the lyrics out, and finally realizes that not only does she not know where she is in the song, I'm not exactly sure she knows she's still in Germany. And she could have done lots of things. She could have just ended the song. She could have giggled her way through. She could have scat sung her way through, certainly. What she does on her feet is make up a brand new song. All the lyrics fit the meter of the song, and all the lyrics rhyme exactly where they should rhyme in a song, as if she'd written this over the course of 3 months. All this is being done spontaneously in the moment on her feet. Now, Norman Granz was wrong. The German audience did speak English, and they knew exactly what she had done. They gave her such an ovation, so much love, so much energy, that she follows this with a 7.5-minute version of How High the Moon, that she sings as if she's on crystal meth. She's on nothing except the audience's energy. Those two songs, back-to-back, are the finest example of jazz singing ever recorded before, then, or probably ever.
As you say, that became part of the living legend. I certainly knew about it when I was just getting into Ella Fitzgerald. That really propelled her into even higher stratosphere, didn't it?
The Great American Songbook series, especially the Cole Porter Songbook, took Ella out of being another good singer to, like, wow, maybe she is the best at what she does. But this moment where she sings Mack the Knife, which I have to know, is that she won a Grammy Award for Best Song, a Grammy Award for Best Album, and Mack the Knife became her second theme song after A Tisket a Tasket, as well as Bobby Darin and Louis Armstrong's versions were. Ella's version became legendary. And for the rest of her life, anytime she sang that song, the audiences went crazy. But to get 2 Grammys for doing this, that's the moment where Ella becomes a legend, where the joke was, and I think the most recent person was Lucy Arnaz to say this, anytime Ella Fitzgerald made a mistake, she had a hit song.
It's interesting to put it that way. I just want to wrap here, because unfortunately we're tight on time, with the idea that here's this amazing woman who did so much musically and so much culturally, and it was her peers And I'll mention one in particular, my favorite male vocalist, Mel Torme. Her peers who couldn't wait to publicly thank her in music. And Mel did it many, many times in concerts in the 70s. And when she passed, I remember he would do his tributes to her. And he was another great scatter. But she really affected people, both the audiences and the musicians, didn't she?
Did. There was a wonderful story that they were talking about musicians being backstage, and you're nervous before you go on, so they play a game. Who's your favorite trumpeter? Who's your favorite pianist? Who's your favorite whatever? And then they'd say, who's your favorite singer? And the game could not go even 1 minute longer unless the answer was, oh, you mean besides Ella?
Love that. Love that. Your book is timely and important for all the right reasons, but I think we do need to focus on these kinds of individuals in the 20th century who are such trailblazers, but also whose music will endure. I'm often saying to my friends and children, Mozart will be around for the next 300 years. I would safely say Ella Fitzgerald for the next 500. Wouldn't you agree?
I will agree and tell you that no one would be more pleased about it than Ella. The idea that we can listen to her and watch her, because there's concerts available now that you can see, that she could still, through the magic of electronics, still be having a concert and still having you guys out there enjoy it, would make her so very happy. It's what she lived for. And that even though she's not here, she's still here, would make her very, very happy.
I hope my listeners, I know they will, rush to Amazon.com to order Jeffrey Mark's wonderful book, Ella, A Biography of the Legendary Ella Fitzgerald. And there's a term, legendary, thrown around a lot these days, but in her case, it matters. Jeffrey, such a nice pleasure to chat with you and share some music and some memories. I wish you the best with the book.
I thank you, and please have me back on again. This is a lot of fun.
You've been listening to On Mic with Jordan Rich, a podcast produced by Chart Productions. Just click the Jordan Rich podcast link at chartproductions.com for more. Please subscribe, download, rate, and review us on Apple and any other podcast platform. Hey, it's great to be with you as always. Thanks for listening. Have a terrific day.